Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for joining us this evening or this morning, whatever the case may be on your end. What's shaking out there? You know, if you're like me, you've spent a lot of hours this past week glued to the television, watching dramatic events unfold in Europe. It's been a long time since Americans watched in real time a war engulf a Western country. We've kind of become accustomed to watching American troops battling in desert climates in cities or towns or dusty outposts that don't really look that much like our own homes or our own hometowns. It's all very real and very serious, but I'm not sure TV viewers relate in the same way they do to what's happening now. Just making an observation, not saying that I agree with that, but to see tanks and missiles and bombs and warplanes unleashing hell and death in a modern city, in a Western city, not unlike the cities where most of us live, it's another thing altogether. I suspect it's made people watching at home imagine what it would be like if tanks rolled into their hometowns. It's pretty much a nearly universal observation, I think, by this point, to express admiration for the grit and courage of Ukrainians facing off against one of the world's most powerful militaries, the largest ground army in Europe, the mighty Russians. These Ukrainians are showing us they are courageous, plucky even, and I think if Vlad Putin thought they'd be easy pushovers, he was wrong. But, you know, when Putin starts talking about amping up his country's nuclear arsenal, putting them on high alert, warning other countries that they might face Russia's wrath if they get involved, that's serious stuff, even if he's bluffing. I mean, he certainly wasn't bluffing about invading Ukraine. As many talking heads had predicted, oh, he'll never invade, they told us. Well, he did. You know, and I hope it's at least a wake-up call for those in our country who think Putin is our bosom buddy. And I had a chance to meet a lot of Russians over the years, both here in the U.S. and in Russia itself during my visits there, and they're just so much like us here in the U.S. and North America, trying to make their way in a changing world, trying to hang on, really? I mean, is there all that much support for an invasion of Ukraine among the Russian people? I kind of doubt it. You know, this is going to be bad for them, and a lot of Russians are going to die before it's over, along with Ukrainians, of course. They're already dying, and at least now, I hope Americans will be able to find Ukraine on a map. You know, what happens there does affect us. It is something we will feel as well as this goes on. Tonight, we take a break from world tensions for a few hours to delve into enduring mysteries, and we travel down some dark paths. Coming up in this first half tonight, parapsychologist Dr. Barry Taff returns to the program. He was my guest a couple of years ago and regaled us with chilling stories about some of the infamous hauntings and poltergeist cases that he has personally investigated, many of them world famous. You remember the Entity case that was turned into a Hollywood movie by that title, The Entity, the one with Barbara Hershey in it. That's based on true events, and Barry Taff was there when all that weirdness was unfolding. He was also involved in the aftermath of the Sharon Tate murders, a house on that same street that was really messed up with a lot of weird stuff going on. Dr. Taff has spent more than 40 years looking into bizarre events, always with the intention of starting with trying to find weird but prosaic explanations, not necessarily paranormal. More recently, though, he's brought something home with him, something downright spooky and invasive and not all that friendly. We're going to catch up with him, talk about some of his most famous investigations, try to look for some common denominators that tie together different types of so-called paranormal phenomena. In the second half tonight, mysteries of a different sort. As our listeners know, you know, Coast relies so much on our bumper tunes. I kind of help set the mood for our guests and our topics. We often chit-chat about the songs and the artists on this program, little tidbits of info here and there. But as we know, in the world of popular music, especially rock and roll, there are so many unusual tales, blatant omissions, spin doctors giving their spin on these things, fraudulent facts associated with huge stars and recording artists. Tonight, we are joined by the first time by the rock and roll detective. His name is Jim Birkenstadt, and he's been a music industry insider for a lot of years, giving him access to artists and producers and record execs that helped him resolve some enduring questions, such as, did the CIA try to assassinate Bob Marley? How did the Beach Boys get hooked up with Charles Manson? And what were the lasting effects of the band? Elvis, the Beatles, Bob Dylan, Traveling Wilburys, hoaxes, rumors, legends, fun stuff coming up a little bit later. Mysteries in the Music is the name of Jim's latest book, and we'll take a deep dive into those pages a little bit later. Our webmaster, Ryan Stacey, and I have pulled together our usual assortment of items and oddities culled from various media sources around the world. We call it Naps News, and you can find it on the Coast to Coast AM website. Among the stories featured tonight, a real-life, long-lost world, a lost continent that was home to amazing and bizarre flora and fauna, that is, 40 million years ago. Also, a think piece about consciousness and the growing perception among scientists that maybe everything has a consciousness to one degree or another. Can that be true? Take a look at the article when you get a moment. Also there, a theory of everything that tries to explain seemingly contradictory versions of reality, you know, relativity versus quantum mechanics, that is. Also, an article that suggests maybe our brain really does replay highlights from our lives, sort of a life review that includes our greatest hits. That is, we reportedly see this right before we die. I personally am not looking forward to finding out if that's true, but it's worth a read. And then for a bit of comic relief, we have a story about magpies, one of nature's most clever creatures. They're smart and a little bit mischievous at times, and some of the tricks they played on their human adversaries are in this piece. Those stories and more in Naps News. And while you're there on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is 15 cents a day. If you subscribe for a year, it gives you access to a huge archive of programs and interviews, including the Art Bell Vault. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want. It's a good deal. So too is Beyond Belief. That's the television show hosted by our colleague George Norrie. He interviews fascinating guests and covers challenging subjects similar to what George does here on the radio. Good deal, too. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the family guard duck, maybe the wombat if you have one. Put on a pot of Joe, throw a log on the fire, slide your bod into those flannel jammies and your toes into your best bunny slippers. Plop yourself down in a comfy spot, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, Paranormal Investigations with parapsychologist Dr. Barry Taff. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Dr. Barry Taff, who holds a doctorate in psychophysiology with a minor in biomedical engineering, is a world-renowned parapsychologist who worked out of UCLA's former parapsychology lab from 1969 through 78 as a research associate. During his four-decade career, he's investigated more than 4,500 cases of ghosts, hauntings, poltergeists, and has conducted extensive studies in telepathy and precognition. He's consulted for government, business, and law enforcement, including the CIA, the NSA, the DIA, the FBI, and Interpol, and on and on. He's written numerous articles for magazines and journals, has been featured in many books and TV programs about paranormal subjects, ranging from precognition to UFOs. His best-known book is called Aliens Above, Ghosts Below. Welcome back, Dr. Taff.
Thank you very much, Jorge. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think before we start getting into some strange events that have intruded into your life in recent months, I want to have some background for those listeners who didn't get to hear you the last time you were here, which was 2 years ago. Parapsychologist is what you call yourself now. Is that what you thought you'd call yourself back when you were getting your PhD? Is that what you'd figured you'd end up?
I really didn't know. Go back a little further. When I was in high school, I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy, get a Doctor of Science degree, become a fighter pilot, and an astronaut, retire as an airlines executive. But I didn't know I wasn't going to be tall enough and have vision good enough to do that. So it didn't work. At UCLA, I went to graduate school at UCLA. I didn't go to undergraduate there. But what got me into this area of interest was growing up as a kid, I was having paranormal experiences, telepathic, precognitive, out of body. I could hold people's clothing or jewelry or keys, and I could tell them things about themselves, called psychometry. And I thought everyone could do this, and maybe they can, but maybe they don't know how. What happened was I got in trouble with it in grammar school. You're 10 years old in the fifth grade, And I remember it was a warm summer, spring day, playing out during recess. A little girl named Christine, a blue-eyed blonde girl, was walking towards me. And the best way of describing what happened is, like, if you really had X-ray vision, like Superman. So I'm looking at her. She's wearing a sky blue dress with a big, like a sunflower on it. And I'm looking at her, and suddenly I could see that under her dress, there was a plastic bag and a tube going in there. I didn't know what a colostomy was. I was 10 years old. So I went up to her. I said, Chris, what's that tube in that bag under your dress? And she started screaming and got the teacher. And they dragged me into the principal's office. And the principal said, did you look in the sneak in a girl's bathroom? Did you look under her dress? I said, I did neither. He goes, then how did you know? Well, it's, you know, like X-ray vision. He goes, what? He goes, I'm going to call your mother. So he called my mother. My mother started explaining that I could do these things. And I remember the principal said to my mother, you're as crazy as your son. And he hung up on my mother. And he said, if I ever hear of this happening, even one more time, I'm going to have you arrested, go to juvenile hall, you're going to go to jail for a while. And it did happen, but I never spoke of it. But before I left his office, I turned back and I said, you got this weird scar. It must have had where your appendix was. Must have had an appendectomy. It's all purple. I called it a keloid. Now I didn't know that word then. And he turned purple on me and yelled, get out. And never saw him again. He didn't bother me anymore. But it's those types of events that were plaguing me when I was young. To show you how extreme it can be, in 2013, and a colleague of mine came over. We've known each other since UCLA. He became a medical doctor. I took the easy way out and got doctorate. He brings by his new girlfriend with her kids. I didn't know her name. I didn't know anything about the kids. They come in my place, and he said, look at her son. Good-looking young boy, about 8, 9 years old, very quiet. And I'm looking at him, and I couldn't believe what I saw, because the best way to describe it is that the frontal regions of his brain weren't there. It was like just an empty space. And my colleague, my friend, Dr. Stoller, said he has cortical encephalopathy, a disease that eats away the brain. And his mother was sitting there on the couch, and she turned kind of white and green, and she said to my friend, you told him, and he didn't tell me anything. So then she said, okay, look at me. So I looked at her, and I said, you must have smoked a lot. Your lungs look like old brown paper bags. There's black spots on them. You have COPD, and of course she did, or does, or whatever. And so she freaked out, got up, grabbed her kids, ran out of my place, and she said, I never want to hear that man's name again. So it's things like that that got me into this field, and I thought other people could do them. But I took two areas of interest. In a clinical sense, I was interested, could other people who weren't considered to be psychic or gifted or had a high potential for this, could they be trained to enhance whatever inherent abilities they might have? And if they can it be directed in a way where it's productive, meaning it can be demonstrated over and over again? So that was the work I did in the lab, went on for years and years, and that's how I met at least people from the intelligence community and the military. And they showed up in civilian clothes. I didn't know who they were. And some of our information we conveyed, this is the 1971, was so state-specific regarding the Trident sub, the Ohio-class sub in development, and their new Trident, their D-3 or D-2 missile. They demanded we surrender the audio tape we made, because how could we know? Anyway, it got really interesting, and we learned a lot from doing this work for, like, 1971. It ran past the lab closing about 1987 in office complexes in Westwood. So that was great, and we learned a lot.
And did this intersect with Stanford Research Institute and what we now know as remote viewing?
Yes and no. Let's just say the intelligence people were very interested in what we were doing, because we did a number of sessions for them and it worked quite well. They wanted us to work with them. I said, great. But UCLA said, no way. Would have been political suicide to have UCLA and the Neuropsychiatric Institute, which is where our lab was located, to have us associated with the paranormal would have been political suicide even back then.
Well, I would also think being involved with the CIA could be a black mark, because, you know, everybody was dumping on the CIA back then.
But But it's even worse than that. The man who ran the NPI, Dr. Julian West, he was involved with orbital undercutting and psychosurgery and MKUltra a long time ago.
Oh, boy.
And so that would have been a double negative. And as we all know, universities function on endowments. The public discovered that UCLA was formally involved with the funding of such paranormal research. They could kiss their money goodbye. Oh. You know, the endowments would disappear.
Well, so. I was going to ask you about that. You know, in those days, it took courage for UCLA to have a parapsychology lab, I would think. It was a spirit of adventure and investigation that you would applaud, but I can't imagine them doing it today.
As long as we didn't get too much publicity, and this is what killed both the lab and myself, I was in the Daily Bruin 3 times. I was in the cover of the UCLA Monthly in 1974 with my picture. We were in the lab and talking about what we're doing, and it was interesting. And then INLA came to the lab, KABC, and they wanted to do a show, Talking Heads. I go, no, we've got to do something more visually oriented than people talking. I said, let's show the public what a ghost or an apparition might be. And they went, what do you mean? What's the only thing in our real world that correlates to an apparition? A hologram. Let's show people holography. And we did. Went to a lab I was working with in West Los Angeles at the time. And I did some narration, and as they did. And we got nominated for an Emmy, which was good. But it was the first use of holography in commercial television.
Wow. Wow.
Other than documentaries that might have been made. So we got a lot of attention. And I thought this was great. No, it was all strike after strike. All this was too much publicity. Then I was, one of my cases made it to the front page, the View section of the LA Times in 1976. It was on Hollymont Drive in Hollywood, 6221 Hollymont. The house is still there. It's probably still haunted. At least last time I was there, it was in 2008. And it's one of the cases where we got to witness phenomena while we were there versus hearing it from people that had been there weeks or months earlier. And this is what makes these things interesting, is that the chance of any one of us going to an environment that's classified as being haunted or a poltergeist-laden environment and expecting to actually encounter something that we perceive that could be documented, it's like winning the lottery at the billion-dollar level. It's extremely remote. But if you do this long enough, you might be in the right place at the right time and able to somewhat document. And that's, I've been lucky. I've been in the field actually more than 40 years, been 50, almost 53 years.
Well, we're going to get into some of the cases in the next segment. But for now, you know, today the word skeptic has been hijacked. And it now means people who use the term skeptic, it means they're debunkers, really. They're as rigid in their belief as the most wild-eyed true believer. And that then nothing can be true, no matter what evidence exists to prove it. So they automatically discard evidence and in a way to explain things away, things that we might classify as paranormal, regardless of what the evidence actually shows. You are a skeptic in the true meaning of it, in the sense that show me, you know, and although you have explained away a lot of the cases you investigated by looking first for prosaic explanations, you are open to the possibility that something really weird is going on out there. Am I correct?
Right. And once we get past the real things that are not paranormal in nature, we're misinterpreting normal events. We're people who are embellishing or exaggerating things they don't understand fully. And once you get past that, and people who are drinking too much, who are doing drugs, who whatever, they have mental problems, you know, emotional problem. Once you get past that, then you got to take a careful look at what you're dealing with. And in science, Occam's razor, all things being equal, you go with the simplest explanation that explains the phenomena under observation. And laboratory stuff is way different because you can't make a lot of this stuff perform in a lab. It just doesn't happen all the time. It's too many variables.
Yeah.
In the field, almost never happens. However, if you're in the field for a long enough period of time, a number of decades, you could collect data, a lot of data, and see if there are longitudinal patterns that appear in the data. And they're there. And they're so blatant, it's rather scary because this whole thing may be a lot simpler than we ever imagined, but a lot more disturbing.
All right, Dr. Barry Taff, we're going to get into some of the most famous cases that you've investigated, the Sharon Tate-Manson connection, as well as the Enity case, then into some current events. We're looking into the possibility of spirits, entities, poltergeists, ghosts, demons, with my guest, Dr. Barry Taff, who's dug into several thousand cases of alleged hauntings, things of that nature, trying to get to the bottom of those. In many cases, he's been able to come up with explanations that are weird, but not necessarily paranormal. For example, he advances the idea that people can be receptors, not only receptors, but also, in effect, broadcasters of strange phenomena. In effect, they generate it, send it out. Places can also do that. Houses, specific locations. For example, there's one that we're going to talk about, an infamous address on a street known as Cielo Drive. I think you might know what happened there. We'll get into that and more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Barry Taff, let's jump into some of the cases that you've investigated. Cielo Drive is what I teased a couple of minutes ago. It is, of course, the street where Sharon Tate lived, gruesome murders carried out by Charlie Manson and his, or carried out by his disciples, rather. But Manson, I think everyone would agree in retrospect that that guy is about as evil as a human can get. Tell me how it came to be that you investigated the house in that neck of the woods. What did you see, what was reported, and what you found?
A friend of mine by the name of Steve Rubin was hired by the owner of the house, who had made a low-budget movie about him living in the house and all the things that he experienced. And Steve knew me from a long time before. He got hold of me. I went out there, and he told me where it was. I didn't know anything about it. So after interviewing the owner of the house, a man who lived there by the name of David Oman, you know, it was interesting what he was saying. And I come back there at another time with my instruments and some of my colleagues. What I didn't know was what the groundbreaking information was going to turn out to be. The geomagnetic field in that house was anywhere from 20 to 100 times normal. We were getting readings of a couple thousand milligauss, which is mind-boggling. One end of the house would have negative polarity, the other end would have positive polarity, like a giant magnet. Things being thrown at people, luminous anomaly, disembodied voices. I was leaving the kitchen once, I get a glass of water, and I see a glass go sailing over my shoulder to the floor with water in it, and I was the only one there. People saw it, but I didn't see it till it passed me. But what we learned about this was extraordinary. I worked on that case for approximately 1 year. I was there 21 times. It was relatively close to where I lived back then. And I didn't know what would happen to me because I've never been in an environment like that before. And I started, every time I left the house, I got really sick. My stomach, my whole body hurt, like someone beat me up. And I had to go to the hospital, the ER, like either right after I left or the next morning, because it was tearing me apart. And I'm going, this is really odd. I've never had this happen before. And every time. So the amplitude, the readings were so high, there was a stairwell at the back of the house, started at street level and worked its way down. And there's a cast iron railing. And when I grabbed the railing, I felt a tingling go up my arm, into my neck, and I passed out, which I generally don't tend to do. At the bottom of the stairwell, taking measurements, you're getting a couple, I think up to 100 gauss, which is incredibly high. And again, I blacked out. I woke up on the floor going, what happened? Over the course of 1 year, I met a total of 58 people that came through the house visiting it, all of whom were younger than me, most of which did not have any pre-existing medical conditions. And 68% of the people got sick there because their body couldn't cope with the high amplitude of magnetic field. And I suspect that the reason there's activity there is that it's a conducive environment. We know now that we didn't know 40 or 50 years ago that this phenomenon doesn't operate in a vacuum, meaning there are precursors to it. There are environmental parameters that have to be met or variables. If they're met in the right place at the right time, the right people are present, things may happen. And I stopped going to the house in 2006 so I didn't feel like dying. And the doctors at Cedars-Sinai said, if you keep getting sick there, why do you go back? I said, helping to clarify what an understanding of what's going on in the field. And it
basically
did.
They had been reporting, and I guess in this film, really bizarre stuff that sounds like ghosts, poltergeists, spirits, entities, right?
Yeah, here's the problem. 99% of my cases have been poltergeist activity, meaning they're centered around certain people, sometimes certain locations, but usually people. And if the people move, it follows them because it's an extension of a living human psyche that couples with the local electromagnetic environment. And if that coupling is inductively coupled, things may happen. And this is what we've learned, that you could predict it. And the primary predictor is that the majority, if not all, of poltergeist agents I've met over the last 53 years are either seizure-prone or they're epileptic. But the majority of people who are seizure-prone or epileptic are not poltergeist agents. That means there is a missing or unknown variable in the middle somewhere. But some people act as what I'd call a biological operational amplifier. Their body takes what's there, amps it up, and spits it out, reorients it. And things will happen because those people are there.
And are some people that just attract it, that they're more like a sponge as opposed to a broadcast tower?
Some people act as an amplifier. And we'll talk about this and what happened to me, and I lived in a couple homes in the desert. Some people act as amplifiers. Their presence amps up what's there and orients it. And it's amazing because there were so many. We were a case in Pomona back in 2008 or 9. And out there interviewing the woman, she's telling us about her husband moved in with a young daughter, a fixer-upper, and it was great. And suddenly, the place is picked up, and suddenly her husband goes crazy and tries to kill her. He just freaks out. So they arrested him. He brought her to examination. He's tested. They don't know what's going on. They let him go. Okay. Then he comes back, and then a phenomenon starts happening in the home. Disembodied voices, luminous anomalies, banging noises, machines turning on and off, the classic poltergeist activity. Then, out of the blue, her husband pulls out a gun and blows his head off in the dining room in the exact same location the original owner of the house did 50 years earlier.
Oh.
That's bad enough. And the last the woman tells us is, oh, there is one more thing, Dr. Tara. What's that? I suddenly learned I'm epileptic. Is that relevant?
Huh.
Relevant. That's the whole story.
Let's walk back to Cielo Drive. So the people live in Cielo Drive. They think they've got ghosts or spirits that are left behind because of the terrible murders that happened at the Tate home on that same street. That's what they think, right?
Right. And I mean, I can't say no. I can't say yes. But the evidence that I witnessed and experienced and measured into a great wood after another suggests that, yeah, it's paranormal, but it's an extension of the coupling of living human agents in that house with the environment. And the problem is we know enough now, we might be able to artificially trigger these events, make them happen when we want rather than waiting for them. But then there is the problem of morals and ethics. You might seriously end up killing people that are in that environment because they're hypersensitive to electromagnetic fields, and you're going to play God and manipulate them, hopefully to get phenomena to happen and document it on camera. Not a good idea.
So there was there were things in the physical environment that you found that you were
all sorts of things. Things we threw outside ended up back in the house. Measurements on instruments that were unbelievable. Compasses, their needles would start spinning, and that would be a quadrupole. Quadrupoles don't exist in nature. They're man-made. So what's causing that? We had non-magnetic material, glass, leather, plastic, generating magnetic fields, which can't happen, but it did. UCLA geophysics came out, and they said, this place is really magnetic. Yeah, we know that. What can you tell us about it? We do everything from the air. We don't monitor anything on the ground anymore. When they were drilling in the hills to build the house this man, Mr. Owen, lives in, they found the area is on vacuous magma chambers, which means that long before humans existed out here, that area might have become a volcano. But it didn't happen, obviously. Otherwise, with Beverly Hills and most of West LA wouldn't exist. But energy's there. I mean, there are changes in the earth constantly. Now, according to what Mr. Omen's told me, the phenomena has diminished, which is understandable because nothing is constant. You know, there's constant variation. You know, nothing's static. But when some guy wanted me to go back there years ago to do a shoot, and I said, there is no incentive you could offer me that will get me go back to that house. I don't want to die. If he bought me the great best car, I won't. I can't drive it if I'm dead or if I'm crippled.
when you tell the homeowner, hey, it's not ghosts. I think it has to do with geomagnetic anomalies. Plus, the house had been built with these giant iron spikes, and then maybe some people there who were sort of receptors for this stuff. That combination of phenomena created things that might be ascribed to poltergeists. Now, when you tell them that, they can't be happy about it. They want it to be ghosts, right?
Well, see, the thing of it is, George, we may all be describing the same thing, using different words to describe it. The phenomena that was happening while I was there over the course of a year was definitely paranormal, but the mechanism is what couples living humans with the environment, and might this produce a hyper accelerated situation to make this stuff play off the past information that's stored there in some mechanism we don't yet understand? Maybe. I don't know. I'm not God. This is what the evidence is telling us. And you know, when you get 68% of the people coming through there over a year, all of them younger than me, none of them had the problems I had, medically speaking, and 68% got ill. That's incredible. I mean, you could win at the lottery there pretty much every other time you played. So, yes, it's paranormal, but it's far more complicated than we ever imagined.
Let's talk about the entity case for a minute, because people remember that movie with Barbara Hershey. It's spooky. That movie, when you go into it and you see it's based on real events, it sets a framework for you that this isn't just something made up by Hollywood. This stuff really happened. So you saw some of these things happen.
Yeah, right? My colleague at the time, Carrie Gaynor, was in a bookstore in Westwood, one of the only totally accurate elements of the movie. They shot in the actual bookstore that was there, which still existed. And Doris and her friend, Doris Byther was the lady in question, heard my colleague talking about our work with a friend. She turned to them and said, my house is haunted. So Carrie got her name and number. I called her a few days later, went out to visit her house on Braddock Drive in Culver City. And I had not met her yet. And we walk in there and we're talking to her. The house was really hot summer, very humid, very balmy. And we're talking to her and walked around. And the bedroom was ice cold, but there was no air conditioning. So we're talking in another room of the house. It's stunk at a very bad odor of decomposing organic matter. And the very first thing she tells us is that she'd been repeatedly raped by ghosts. I thought, oh my God, this woman's psychotic. And I was very upfront. You know, I rolled my eyes back in my head and I put my head in forehead in my hand and I went, oh God, I said, look, Doris, there's nothing we can do. We're not psychiatrists. I gave her some names of some doctors at UCLA might be able to help her. Well, tell them that I referred you and nothing. About 10 days later, she called us. A friend and a neighbor had witnessed us. Well, that changed everything, hopefully. We go back. We still felt nauseous there. It was dizzy, terrible odor. We're in the kitchen talking with her, and the lower cupboard door flies open, and then a skillet goes flying across the kitchen several feet, drops to the floor. No wires, no springs, no children, no animals in the cabinet. Now, she had three male children and one female child. We never met the youngest, the female, but we met three boys. One was older, larger guy, and the other two were younger and smaller. Now, what's important about this case is Doris was a very troubled lady. She'd been disowned by her family, very difficult person to deal with. When we were interviewing her the very first time we were there, she wouldn't even give us her age. That's not a situation you want to be investigating. We didn't have much of a choice. Anyway, she claimed there were three entities. There were two smaller ones that would hold her down and one big one that would rape her or assault her. and she had three male children, walked around the house half nude most of the time, and she drank a lot of beer while we're there. She reeked of it. So does that mean there was no phenomena? No. Is it mediated by alcohol and stress and anxiety and libidinous fantasies? Perhaps. But we couldn't rule it out. So we began going there and seeing these really strange, what I called corpuscular masses of light. Remember the old lava lamps back in the 70s?
Sure. Yeah. I wish I had one now, but yeah.
It was always a lime green, like a pulsating 3D image of light, a bunch of them, zipping around her bedroom. And look at that, wow. And so we brought in some professional photographers because, you know, I am not one. Then we brought in some people that I knew and my colleague knew, and taking pictures. We got one picture that was extraordinary. You see a ball of light with a tail on it. The problem is we couldn't tell the speed at which it was moving. We didn't know from what direction it came from or went to, because there was no reference. So what we did is we went back to Doris's house, and we covered the walls of her bedroom, which is where the phenomena was focused, and the ceiling with black poster boards and duct tape, forming a grid. And each piece of paper or would have a magnetic orientation and a number, so we know where something started and where it ended. And at one point, we investigated the case for about almost three months. At one point, these lights, before I get to that, we saw these lights zipping around Doris Beither. So our people were taking pictures. And we used regular film, we used Kodak Tri-X and pushed it some to increase its sensitivity. And it produced images we never saw. We saw balls of light. The primary image was one of Doris sort of cowering on the bed she's sitting on. And over her head is a luminous arc of energy that goes over and around her. And wow. And the most impressive thing that my colleague Gary Gaynor mentioned was that the walls behind the arc met at a 90-degree angle. They were perpendicular to each other. Had this light been a projected source, meaning a hoax, a fraud, it would have been bent in accordance with the walls, which it was not. It was in free space. And then we got another shot in the same room of two arcs, one going bottom to bottom, the other going top to top, inverted arcs. What was interesting, a couple months ago, the Skeptical Inquirer, that bastion of paranormal reality, published two articles on the case, and they didn't follow the normal tact of debunkers, where they would say there was no lab, it was all made up, there was no case. They did it to make money, to make a movie and make money from whatever. But the weirdest thing they said was that the arcs of light we captured were actually follicles of hair that were floating in the air. And I said, boy, you people are using the wrong thing to clean your hair every morning. What can I say?
I'll tell you what, Dr. Barry Taff, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, I want to get into your stories, what's happening to you now. Because, you know, in all these cases we're discussing, you've been the observer. But then, more recently, you've become the experiencer or even the target. We're talking about Dr. Barry Taff, author of Aliens Above, Ghosts Below.